I'm Gary Bornson, which doesn't say much. Last night, I gave a talk that a number of you were at on the connections between the new physics and peace and justice questions. And unfortunately, I talked the whole time about the new physics, didn't save time for anybody else to talk, didn't save time for any talk about peace and justice, and didn't save time for any talk about the connections between the new physics and peace and justice. So I'm hoping not to get quite so carried away today and be able to deal with just a very quick, superficial summary of the elements of the new physics that I was trying to extract and that I found interesting, and then to talk a little bit about the relationships of those with sort of a peace-justice ethic. That peace-justice ethic is what, to me, in a secular context, informs green politics, which is the official title of this talk, Green Politics. I approach the peace-justice ethic from a Christian perspective. It takes on a little different character then, and there are elements of it that I think the secularists are missing. But I'm, as far as secular movements go, as secular politics goes, I find the particular integration of values that the green politics people in Germany, where it kind of started, and in the U.S., where it's also flourishing, sort of starting to flourish, the particular combination of values that they emphasize ties in very closely with my Christian ethics and also with my physics insights. So I want to try and make some of those connections for you today. There's all kinds of routes into a very similar ethic, and that's part of what Fritjof Capra was noticing back in the 1983, I think, when he published Turning Point. It's similar to what Marilyn Ferguson noticed back in 1980 when she published The Aquarian Conspiracy. This was 82. Which has some of the elements. Fritjof Capra and Marilyn Ferguson would be very kindred spirits, but Capra is a little bit less, California, and a little more global in his perspective, I think. Marilyn Ferguson, although I liked a lot of things about the Aquarian Conspiracy book, I felt it was sort of a little too new agey for a lot of people that don't live in California and don't speak that jargon. Whereas Capra, to me, speaks a little bit more universally. He's European himself. He was raised in Austria, went to school there, and now lives in California, which is not too much to be blamed. Pardon to any Californians that happen to be here. I spent 4 years there, so I can speak as a native. Only people that have lived there for a while can really criticize it. Okay, the elements of physics that I wanted to emphasize were, of the new physics, were the appreciation of the interconnectedness of things, the interdependency of things, the openness, the intrinsic openness of things. I mean, things can't be connected unless they're open to each other. So there's a sense in which physics pays more attention now, not to the boundaries, but to the breaks in those boundaries, to the openness. To the lack of boundaries, or to the impossibility of defining rigid boundaries about anything. I mean, this isn't just electrons, it isn't just people, it isn't just theories, it isn't just words, but anything that we thingify, that we put into boxes and try to name and label and contain, reaches out, has extent through those boundaries that we try to draw. And so attention is being called now with the linguistics and physics and mathematics and new logics and all kinds of things to the need to pay attention to boundaries being sort of fuzzy, sort of not clean, tight boxes. The whole realm of systems theory has developed since about the 1940s or 50s, and it's dealing especially with open systems. Participatory. Interconnected, interdependent, open, participatory. If things interact, they participate one with another in things. Participatory, I set up as in contradistinction to mastery. A lot of people set up mastery as sort of the thing that the male-dominated world we've got is, that's the big problem with it. It's this mastery mentality. We have to control everything, master it. The opposite of that is not submission. The opposite of mastery is participation, is coming in as a participator, not as a master. Coming in as one who joins the common enterprise rather than as one who tries to control things all the time. Dealing with that as a college professor has been hard for me. College professors tend to do this. Here you are all, and here I am, you know. I teach at a place that's an alternative type of school, which has a lot more informal, sit around, classroom, dialogue type classes than lecture format. Lecture format is kind of awkward for me. I'm not a good public speaker. I really struggle with situations where I'm actually speaking out. But I like dialogue, and I really value that. I feel like you don't arrive at truth by yourself. You can't sit in your own little world and meditate and arrive at some kind of, maybe some people can't, I can't. It has to be an interactive process, a co-creative process. And I think that's suggested with some of the new physics. It's suggested partly by the interaction of things. It's also suggested in the limits that the physicists arrived at when they started to try and pin down an electron, let's say. They wanted to say, okay, we've set up an experiment. Here it is. We've got two slits. The electron comes flying through here. It's going to either go through slit A or slit B and hit the screen over here. And we know that if we cover up this slit, it's got to go through this slit. If we cover up this slit, it's got to go through this slit. We've got controls. That's the whole name of the game in science, is control. And yet they started finding out that as they tried to pin that electron down and say, okay, now we open the two slits and we're not looking at it. Does it go through slit A or slit B? And they found out they couldn't say. No matter how hard they tried to control the situation, if they weren't actually measuring it, they couldn't say which hole it went through. And in fact, it went through both. I mean, in fact, they could show that it went through both whenever they weren't looking. But as soon as they looked, it went through either one hole or the other. It was really a frustrating time in physics. And they said, I mean, there's a famous statement of Richard Feynman, who's one of the Nobel Prize folk, worked on these theories quite a long time, 113. He says, I think it is safe to say that no one understands quantum mechanics. Do not keep saying to yourself, if you can possibly avoid it, but how can it be like that? Because you will go down the drain into a blind alley from which nobody has yet escaped. Nobody knows how it can be like that. It just is. It's really weird, but that's the way nature seems to be, and it frustrates the theorists. So what they come up with is these probabilistic explanations. These explanations that depend upon them, it depends upon all kinds of other things, and it depends on chance. And their sense of control, of determinism, of we'll set up the initial conditions and see where it goes to, following some deterministic laws, that sense of physics is lost now. So it's non-deterministic. That's participatory as opposed to mastery. Non-deterministic, perspective dependent, and I even said going so far as to say not objective or subjective. Reality is in part created by the observer. It's intrinsically indeterminate, undefinable. The same initial conditions, identical initial conditions, can go off in totally different directions. That's very much against Newtonian and Cartesian type of physics, which said you set up the initial conditions and it's got to go a certain way. Now we set up the same initial conditions, exactly the same, as much as we can make it exact. And it's not even experimental, it's even theoretical. We set up theoretically the same initial conditions and they go different ways. And that's what a chaotic universe we live in now. It gives God a lot of free rein if God wants to use it. It's there. It gives us a lot of free will in a sense. If there's any mind control over these, what were one time thought to be deterministic forces, there's a lot of room for that in modern physics. Some people really delight in that. Yeah. It's also paradoxical. I gave you maybe some flavor of that. I would like to do more of that, but there's a sense in which modern physics is very paradoxical, and that we develop a mathematics to deal with paradox, but we don't ever get it in our gut very. We never come to peace with it really in our gut. We just sort of learn to live with it. And I guess I found that really exciting, that the physicists, the ones who do take their theories seriously and try to wrestle with them in their mind, wind up sort of like solving a koan, a paradox, where you just live with the tension of the paradox in your mind and in your gut, and that tension itself is creative. It leads you to new insights or new enlightenment. I think there's some of that physicists have experienced because they've had to live with a field that is so weird ever since quantum mechanics came along and relativity. It's counterintuitive. Now, what does that have to do with peace and justice and green politics? I guess, to me, there's some obvious connections, but I'll try to belabor them a little bit. When you hear people in the church talk about shalom, a new appreciation of the word shalom has come about in the past, 10, 15 years? And I'm not sure who's responsible for it, but there's been a lot of theological essays and treatises and sermons given from pulpits on the concept of shalom as being a word that at one time was translated peace, at another time maybe was translated health, and it's used pretty much interchangeably with peace by a lot of people nowadays. But we know from the linguistic studies and from all these theological treatises and scholars that have been addressing the thing, I think I know this anyway, maybe I've got a part of a picture, that shalom, as the Hebrews used the word, was a very, what we call now, holistic concept. It incorporated not just peace in the sense of absence of strife, or peace in the sense of absence of war, or in the peace of absence of arguments or conflicts in that sense, nor even just peace as peace of mind, absence of stress. But it meant peace in the sense of harmony, of oneness with God, oneness with one another, a certain balance or beauty in the way relationships operated, certainly it involved both body and mind and spirit, both body, mind, spirit. It was a holistic concept within the person and within the community and between the nation and other nations. So it had these many dimensions to it. It recognizes that to have shalom, you have to have not just good health, not just enough to eat, not just a sense of wholeness in your body, but you had to have a good family relationships. You had to have your family have good relationships with other families, and those families good relationships with other families, and that community have good relationships with other communities, and all of that under the shadow of God's wings. All in a context of divine lordship, responsiveness to God. Shalom, thus, wasn't really a state of being, because that was never achieved. It was a process of responsiveness. It was a participation of the community in God's redemptive and healing processes among us all the time. Now, I'm not sure if that. Yes, go ahead.
A church I go to uses shalom instead of amen.
Oh, really?
All the time.
Wow.
It's a very nice feeling.
Mm-hmm. And
it's a lot wider than amen.
As we keep,
amen is just so deep.
Right. As we keep sort of broadening our appreciation for shalom, I think that is something like what the physicist is talking about when they say everything's connected with everything else. Or what the mystic is talking about when they say the same thing, coming to the same insight by a process of meditation, as compared to a process of analytic investigation. And as you appreciate that interconnection, interconnectedness and interdependency, your reliance not both on your inner resources and on the people with whom you're in acquaintanceship and on God, God both as someone external to you and as someone internal to you, someone transcendent and immanent, that all that somehow is connected, and all that is empowering, and all that is where you want to look for healing and where you want to look for power to help others in healing processes. That's, to me, I guess, what peace is all about. What shalom, using the word shalom in the broader context than just getting rid of nuclear weapons, for example. We have the word in English, health, which is almost closer to the word shalom than I think peace is. I guess I like the word, the health emphasis more than the peace emphasis. Because I think when a community is healthy, then it's at peace. It doesn't mean that there's lack of, it doesn't mean that there's total agreement. There may be all kinds of disagreement. There may even be stress, creative stress. But there's health in that stress. There's growth occurring in that. There's healing occurring because of stresses. So there are healthy stresses, and then there are unhealthy stresses, and we won't get into all that. But I like the word health. It is one of my big values. The word health comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, H-A-L, hail, which we also have the word hale and hearty. Okay, that's the root for the word health. And the word hale also means whole. So wholeness, health, healing, hale, are all related etymologically, and in our minds, they all lead to that. To me, that's the English equivalent or the Anglo-Saxon equivalent of the shalom concept in the. When you start attuning yourself to all these interrelationships, it's an exciting feeling to start seeing that what at one point looked like a bunch of various a hodgepodge of movements and scenes and problems that just seemed overwhelming. When you start seeing those as interconnecting and interrelated, to me that gets to be exciting, and it gives me more hope for the possibility of transformation. For some people, it's depressing. They say, oh my God, not only is there this problem, but there's this one, this one, this one, this one, they all fit together. Besides, and if I try to do something over here, it's going to make something worse over here, and oh, it's just hopeless. I guess I kind of get excited about that, because it's sort of like for years we've been trying to turn our hand over, me trying to turn this finger and you trying to turn this finger and somebody else we're all trying to turn fingers of the hand over, and we finally start seeing, oh, it's all connected, and if we all get together back here and flip the whole hand over, we can solve all these problems at once. And instead of fighting over fingers and who's got the best finger and who's got the crucial finger and which one is the real important one, we can start seeing the connections and realize that if we can kind of get at the root of things, that we might have several of these places that I didn't read indicate that they are sort of carving out new grounds in the sciences, and that they recognize that like this interpretation of quantum mechanics is a minority interpretation. It's not where the mainstream is right now, but I think it's there. It's in the wind. People talk about it. And that would be true, I suppose, in the medical profession, too. Holistic healing has been around. Holistic health has been around for thousands of years. But to integrate that with Western medicine, to see what Western medicine can learn from holistic approaches, and to start making a sort of indigenous Western holistic health program is something that's only been happening in the past 5 or 10 years. And there are some people that just say, well, 90% of that is just quackery and don't want to have anything to do with it. But nobody is quite sure which 90%, so, and which 10% is extremely valid, extremely useful, and worthy of attention. There's a lot of physicists that will say 90% of copper is quackery, too. And I almost don't care. I mean, I almost don't care if 90% of it is quackery. Even if the physics that copper is talking about is not quite right, although I think it is, and I'm, I mean, I've learned the physics. I think he's not very misleading in the way he represents the physics. But even if his physics were a little bit inaccurate, that doesn't bother me so much, because it's the imagery that he's evoking and the power of those images and the connections that he's observing that and the sort of the inspiration that that can give that to me is exciting. The way it challenges my customary ways of thinking and viewing things, that to me makes it worthwhile. Even if it's not, and it probably isn't, any kind of absolute, you know, or higher truth, at least it's opening, and it's the interplay of the new ideas with the old ideas that I think gives rise to a new vitality in our ability to deal with some of the problems that face us. Especially because those problems are systemic in nature. The problems themselves interact. And I wanted to pick out a section. Now we're moving into green politics. there's one paragraph in this book which happens to be identical to a paragraph in The Turning Point. They're both written by Capra, who's a physicist. This one's also written by Charlene Spretnak, who's a feminist. She's written a book called, that I haven't read, that I've got to read. It's bound to be good. Politics of Women's Spirituality. And after reading this and knowing that she was a primary author of this, I'm really excited to read The Politics of Women's Spirituality. Have any of you read that? No. I think it's in the bookstore. It's in the bookstore. Okay, I should have held it up today. This one's not in the bookstore because it's still in hardback and it's too expensive, so they don't carry it yet. But it'll be there pretty soon, probably. And that paragraph is in the preface, page XVII, and it says, the starting point of green politics, only the last part of the paragraph is in the turning point. The starting point of green politics is the recognition that we find ourselves in a multifaceted global crisis that touches every aspect of our lives, our health and livelihood, the quality of our environment and our social relationships, our economy, our technology, our politics, our very survival on the planet. The nations of the world have stockpiled more than 50,000 nuclear warheads, enough to destroy the entire world several times over, and the arms race continues at undiminished speed. While worldwide military spending is more than $1 billion a day, more than 15 million people die of starvation annually, 32 every minute, most of them children. 32 a minute. Developing countries spend more than three times as much on armaments as on health care. 35% of humanity lacks safe drinking water, about a third, while nearly half of its scientists and engineers are engaged in the technology of making weapons. I hadn't realized that. Half of my fellow scientists and engineers are engaged in the technology of making weapons. Economists are obsessed with building economies based on unlimited growth, while our finite resources are rapidly dwindling. Seems to be a contradiction there. Industrial corporations dump toxic wastes somewhere else rather than neutralizing them, without caring that in an ecosystem there is no somewhere else. Modern medicine often endangers our health, and the Defense Department itself has become a threat to our national security. Our politicians no longer know where to turn to minimize the damage. They argue about priorities and about the relative merits of short-term technological and economic fixes without realizing that the major problems of our time are simply different facets of a single crisis. They are systemic problems, which means that they are closely interconnected and interdependent. They cannot be understood through the fragmented approaches pursued by our academic disciplines and government agencies. Rather than solving any of our difficulties, such approaches merely shift them around in a complex web of social and ecological relations. A resolution can be found only if the structure of the web itself has changed, and this will involve profound transformations of our social and political institutions, our values, and our ideas. The first step in overcoming the crisis is to recognize a new paradigm. Some of you might recognize that word. A new vision of reality. The beginnings of this change are already visible and are likely to dominate the entire decade. I would say the beginnings of this change are visible and are likely to dominate our entire lifetimes. I don't think it's going to be over in a decade. The paradigm that is now beginning to recede has dominated our culture for several hundred years, and some would say several thousand years, during which it has shaped our modern Western society and has significantly influenced the rest of the world. This paradigm or worldview consists of a number of ideas and values, among them the belief in the universe as a mechanical system composed of elementary material building blocks, and the view of the human body as a machine, and the view of life in society as a competitive struggle for existence, and the belief in unlimited material progress to be achieved through economic and technological growth. And last and not least, the belief that a society in which the female is everywhere subsumed under the male is one that follows a basic law of nature. During recent decades, all of these assumptions have been found severely limited and in need of radical revision. The emergence of green politics in many countries is part of that revision. It is an ecological, holistic, and feminist movement that transcends the old political framework of left versus right. It emphasizes the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena, as well as the embeddedness of individuals and societies in the cyclical processes of nature. It addresses the unjust and destructive dynamics of patriarchy. It calls for social responsibility and a sound, sustainable economic system, one that is ecological, decentralized, equitable, and comprised of flexible institutions, one in which people have significant control over their lives. That's sort of a summary of all the categories I have up there. In advocating a cooperative world order, green politics rejects all forms of exploitation of nature, of individuals, of social groups, of countries. It is committed to nonviolence at all levels. It encourages a rich cultural life that respects the pluralism within a society, and it honors the inner growth that leads to wisdom and compassion. Green politics, in short, is a political manifestation of the cultural shift to a new paradigm. And this book is about the German Green Party and about that ideology. And they say later on, the German Greens have preceded their American counterparts in transforming holistic theory into political practice. And we can learn a great deal from their successes and their errors. It's a big step, trying to go from all these good sounding things like brotherhood and sisterhood and interdependence and love and peace and shalom and justice and global responsibility and responsibility to the environment and sustainable society, and trying to translate that idealism that's been generated over the past, especially a decade or two, both in religious circles and in secular circles, translate that into realistic policies, realistic politics that might have some effect on changing things, on working within the political structure. I think it has had some effect on changing people's lives, individuals' lives, on reorienting people somewhat to a different priority, set of priorities, and setting them off in slightly different directions. I feel like my life's been changed by an appreciation of some of this interdependency. But it's never a completed change. It's just a tweaking it into a different direction and a movement in a different direction, but it's not I don't feel transformed. I don't feel saved yet. nor do I think it comes that as a big revolutionary breakthrough on the society, that all of a sudden green politics takes over and the whole world is ruled by green politicians and everything's fine all of a sudden. I think it's a constant and probably, you know, forever maybe struggle is all right, effort,
transition,
dance, oh, beautiful, thank you for the word, in bringing about a transformation and a redemption. And I think God's involved in that process, and I think we're called to be participators in that process. I could stop there, but I won't. I can read a couple more things. It's over here. Another physicist, Wheeler, who's a theoretician in the area of general relativity, and not a Christian as far as I know, although maybe he's one of those closet Christians. He gives these spectacular talks to incoming fresh people at Princeton, impressing them with how exciting physics is and all the exciting things going on in physics. They get to be juniors and seniors or graduate students that unfortunately there's no jobs in physics, so why did you bother? Physics nowadays in the theoretical realm is for poets. It's for people who love it for its own sake and just enjoy doing it and exploring it. There's very little money in it. There's very few jobs in it. The grants in that area have been cut way, way back, except in the areas of applied physics. In applied physics, if you want to study, you know, applications, not theory, there's lots of money there, which indicates my bitterness. John Wheeler says, "May the universe in some sense, in some strange sense, be brought into being by the participation of those who participate. The vital act is the act of participation. Participator is the incontrovertible new concept given by quantum mechanics. It strikes down the term observer of classical theory, the man who stands safely behind a thick glass wall and watches what goes on without taking part. It can't be done, quantum mechanics says. Participator is the new concept." And that to me is a call. That's a call to all of us to participate in the, as co-creators in what's going on in the redemption of the bringing of a new earth and a new heaven. And, we can't do much about bringing the new heaven, I guess, but we can do something in, maybe in bringing the new earth and joining with and being sensitive to where God is acting, where the action is, where our fellow co-creators are. I think that's exciting. Okay, I could say more about any one of those, but what I prefer to do, and if there's no other conversation, I will, but if what I prefer to do is to open things up and have some discussion about your feelings about the future, about any hope for green politics. Yes?
When you read the paragraph, word kept coming in my mind is like a utopia or something that, as I look across our culture, a lot of people aren't ready for. Mm-hmm. Because they bought so much into the economic system of competition and movement forward, and the Bible Belt America would rather rally around some other kinds of people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you've got some leading conservatives saying Ronald Reagan's the best president this country's ever had, and God bless Ronald Reagan and the Dobbins. And I mean, a lot of people are really there, and they're rallying around that very strongly, day by day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was, the word kept coming to my mind was, you know, utopia that, and utopias don't ever get pulled off. Holden Village, you know, is here. It's not down in Virginia.
You know, and that, you mean because of the isolation that we have, or?
Well, it's because the rules are here. When you get on the boat, you know what's going to happen.
Okay.
You find out what's going to happen.
Okay.
But when you go to other parts, it's not the same way. And that's frustrating for me, as I heard the paragraph, because I said, that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But is it utopia that can't ever be pulled off? Or is there a way that can be pulled off?
One of the things I like to do is to look at what is Reagan's appeal. And some of his appeal is a promise of a utopia. It's a different utopia, but he's appealed to the aspirations, which are sometimes very idealistic and very very laudable, for, you know, a better world and some of the things here, decentralization. Reagan talks a good decentralization. I'm not sure he does it, but he talks it. Grassroots democracy. I think he'd sort of want to endorse that. I'm not sure he would practice it in the way I would like to see it done, but he believes in, talks about trying to return power to people somehow. What he means by people is different from what I mean by people, but.
He would probably agree with every one of those in another way.
Sort of, yeah.
in his way.
And so I think there are some people that follow Reagan with sort of a misunderstanding, or who would be willing to adopt somewhat closer to my interpretation of some of those values that Reagan would espouse, more closely than what his interpretation does in practice. In other words, do it for me.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, there's such a difference between what he says about Social Security and what he's doing about Social Security. There's such a, you know, that people have bought what he says, not even knowing what he's doing.
Okay, or national debt.
Yeah.
Ah, there's a good one. Everybody doesn't want this horrendous huge debt.
Yeah.
And he can make all kinds of points, political points, by saying, I don't want this big debt either, since the Democrats are doing it. And then he turns around and triples the defense budget, is it? Does anyone know the numbers? It's just outrageous how it's, I mean, the graph just goes crazy in the 5 years he's been in office.
Yeah.
6 years. Five? Hope it's six. Excuse me, for any of you Reagan supporters, I didn't mean this to be a political, I mean, this says, I mean, the big thing at the very top of the book, and it's, I think it's really crucial to remember, it's crucial for me, we are neither right nor left, we are in front. It's pretty arrogant, but there's a sense that the green politics wants to constantly proclaim it's not a right-left duality, it's not either the Democrats, the Republicans, or the liberals, or the conservatives, and in Germany it's very much not that way. In Germany, it's got roots penetrating deep into the conservative party in Germany and into the more liberal politics in Germany. I was very frustrated by having to use the red marker up here to write the principles up there, because they're very much not red, they're green. It's the opposite of red. But it's a conservative politic, meaning conservative in the old-timey sense of values conservative, of ecologically conservative.
Which is the need for a new paradigm, because the old paradigm is what sets up the duality.
Dualities, always.
And the new paradigm says that there isn't a duality. There is life and there's not life, almost. You know,
that's the duality.
Well, that's true.
But that's an important one. Yeah.
Well,
the way it's working in Germany, they actually have a party, a green party. We don't have a green party in this country. There's a green network around this country that's not fielding candidates and not, you know, intending to in the near future. But in Germany, they do have a green party, and they, because they have a parliamentary system rather than a Congress like we have, if they can capture 5% of the vote, they are allowed to have delegates in their Bundestag, their parliament. And so the Green Party at the last election, which was in 82 when Helmut Kohl was, or 83, when Helmut Kohl was elected, the Green Party got 5.6% of the vote. And so they have now 27 delegates in the German parliament. They're also active in the state levels and have delegates in the state houses as well, within Germany, and city governments too. And they get all kinds of flack, yeah. They're shouted down in parliament frequently because their views are very minority and very unpopular. They're not accepted by either the right or the left, although there are sympathetic people in both the, what's called the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, right, that are sympathetic to what the Greens are doing but haven't broken their party ranks. So they are frequently able to sway to either by joining one side or the other, or by trying to be the focus of a coalition, they're able to affect some of their ideals, even though they only have 27 delegates. Well, in Germany, got to remember too, that the church is much more involved in politics than we are in this country. The Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church both have been involved with the peace movement and with the environmental movements and with this coalition of green politics. Some of the leadership in this organization are church folk. You know, here we make this sharp separation. We say, you know, there's the church doing stuff over here, and then there's the our political lives over here, and we don't really want to mix the two very much, or we don't even, in my church at home, gosh, if you even try to talk about a political subject, even a conservative political subject, nobody, they'll just say, the church is the right place to do that. You know, it's
community, right, Polish.
Right. Well, that's the green activity in this country has been in as a green network, and they're like in Bellingham where I'm living. They meet every month. There's been like as many as 80 people at a meeting, which is quite a few. There's a mailing list of maybe 125, 130 people that have indicated support one way or another, and then they're meeting locally in little small, sort of almost like comunidades de base, Latin American based communities, although they wouldn't use that because they're not wanting to be biblical, but they have been meeting in neighborhoods, groups of maybe 10 to 20 people on the odd every other week. See, once a month you have this one, like the first Sunday of the month, first Tuesday of the month, you have the centralized meeting where everybody comes together, and then on second and fourth Tuesdays you'd have the local group, which is sort of more of a neighborhood group. And the base community model was discussed at some length during one of the early organizing meetings in Bellingham with regard to a way of letting the dynamic emerge from the grassroots rather than having some kind of central bureaucratic agency say, okay, these are the issues we're going to deal with, to see where people are and start working at that level. And the small scale, decentralized grassroots principle is really important.
If a revolution is occurring in consciousness, which I believe it is, there's always going to be those forces aligned against that and resisting the change from the old paradigm. And patriarchy certainly represents the old paradigm. And a feminist Catholic nun that I heard speak a few weeks ago spoke of patriarchal recidivism, which is evidenced in many places in the world. Iran would be a classic example, where women step out of line in any way, it's against the wall, or the Baha'i faith is just tormented. The new right in this country would represent our own manifestation of that. The woman's place is, it's very clear. Mm-hmm. And so when you see that occurring, to me, I just see that's the part of the resistance to giving way. That nothing as major a change as a paradigm shift would occur without struggle and pain.
Well, I have to read Copper's little quote at the beginning of his book. Remember, his spirituality is more Eastern than most of ours, probably. But his
Jewish?
No, he's Austrian, but he's doesn't mean he's not Jewish, does it? His major background is in Buddhist and Far Eastern. I'm not sure which particular brand of Eastern thought he's been most involved with, but he quotes the I Ching at the beginning of his Turning Point, and I think he even takes the title from the name of this particular combination of symbols in the I Ching. And the particular message that he delivers here is, after a time of decay comes the turning point. The powerful light that has been banished returns. There is movement, but it is not brought about by force. The movement is natural, rising spontaneously. For this reason, the transformation of the old becomes easy. The old is discarded and the new is introduced. Both measures accord with the time. Therefore, no harm results from the I Ching. It's pretty utopian or idealistic, I suppose, and it's also a little more, the idea of getting rid of the old and introducing the new isn't really what Copper's talking about most of the time. Is that what I'm talking about? There's a sense in which the light does come, there is movement. The powerful light that has been banished returns. there is an enlightenment coming about, but it's not in the sense of discarding. The old is discarded. I don't like that phrase. And the new is introduced. There's a sense in which the old is transformed. And I think that we Christians have some more powerful imagery for redemption and transformation than even the I Ching offers, apparently.
You know what, I was thinking of when you, especially when you were talking about the connection, is that one of the things that we need to understand about leadership is that no leader can lead unless folks are willing to follow. It's really important to, and I also, I think hand in hand, there's two things that go hand in hand. One is that no leadership exists without the willingness of the people to follow. And the other is that no oppression continues once oppression, I think, has been named. That even though the outward circumstances of oppression may still remain, oppression itself, and I think the minute that oppression is ceased,
Part of the power of the oppression is in not being named, that's for sure. I mean, you get the world starts naming apartheid as oppression and evil, it eventually it's going to be seen for what it is. You know, that's another example of some place where they've dug in and refused to let go of that old way. And if powers that be and people start saying, no, that the demon got there, it's killing, not preserving life. It will be increasingly hard to maintain the oppression, I think.
To me, one of the most interesting things to do right now is to look at the concept of denial. Who benefits from denial? Who benefits from denial? And where it seems to me there may be a continuum between denial and repression or censorship, too. Well, which may have something to do with what you said about money, no money for theory, but only money for weapon building, physics, which is not what you said.
It's nice for us to realize what is going on as far as denial and repression. But when you have people in power, administrative power, and they make decisions about school systems, about the thought processes that our children are going to be going through and what they aren't going to be taught or led into or examined, that's pretty lousy. Pretty lousy if you can say, well, that person's just denying, but yet he filters through what the kids are going to be receiving. And I'd like to know some mechanism that we can use.
Well, that's where the networking comes in, I think. I mean, the networking idea in physics, the networking idea in this, that I think we don't have a lot of power personally. I mean, you can get some, but you can really only find it in cooperation with other people, I think. That's the only place I can seem to find it. And in feeling that, oh, gosh, I'm not alone in trying to do this. Somebody else is, and if you get four or five people together, even depending on the scale of the problem you're trying to address, but start with four or five, and right, it's 12 folks to start with, and multiplied from there.
You probably create more options.
Yes. Yes.
It's almost like a
Mark Chapman.
New options of the newsletter that Mark Satin edits that deals with transformation politics. It's kind of one of the foci, or almost the house organ for green politics in this country, although it's kind of preceded green politics, actually, but it's kind of coming to be one of the any green politician would probably recommend New Options newsletter. And the author, or the editor, authored a book back in the mid-70s called New Age Politics.
Is there some kind of appeal politically? How many national political people would say, I'm either super sympathetic or I am a green politician?
there's maybe a half dozen congresspeople that are acquainted with it, that meet regularly with these kinds of people, that would talk, that would say they're sympathetic. The newsletter, the
Ron Dillon.
Dillon. Who?
Harkin and Leach.
It seems like there's one in Minnesota that I don't know what the name is. Yeah. Somebody pretty well known in Minnesota. Everybody knows him. Can't think of his name. They did a survey, the New Options did a survey of, they set up sort of criteria, sort of like the that Democratic group does. They rank according to how your voting record is, and they did a ranking according to how green the voting record was, and they came up with a list of people that they said was basically, you know, pure, but I can't remember who they were.